Shukshing Metok Tram Vira Ling Shin In Degen Padi Sange Shing Du Mik Te Uwagi Jokun Am Dak Shing La Chuparshu Iram Guru Radha Mandalakam Niryatsayami
Sange
Shuram Soki Choknam La Jamchu Bardu Dakni Kyaksuchi Daki Chenyengi Pe Sunamki Jola Penchir Sange Chuparshu
Sange
Chiram Soki Choknam La Jamchu Bardu Dakni Kyaksuchi Daki Chenyengi Pe Sunamki Jola Penchir Sange Chuparshu
Sange
Churang Soki Choknam La Jamchu Bardu Dakni Kyaksuchi Daki Chenyengi Pe Sunamki Jola Penchir Sange Chuparshu. I'm coming right to a meditation. Spine's nice and tall, shoulders are together, then relax down the back. The crown of the head reaches towards the ceiling. Slowly withdrawing your awareness into your body. Letting go of the past and the future. Landing in the present. And getting the sense that you're just letting go of all the storylines, the narrating. Maybe holding on to a sense of something's not right. Just letting go of all those things. And then bringing your awareness to the crown of your head. And slowly scanning down your physical body. Letting go of tension as you go. And there's no rush, take your time. Spend extra time in places where there's extra holding or stress. Once you scan all the way down, start to scan back up. Just as leisurely. And land on your breath, feeling how the breath moves your physical form. You can feel that in the whole body, the chest, at the tip of the nose. And come to the breath again really brightly for the last few moments. Thinking, awesome, good job. Releasing the breath and expanding your focus to the whole body. Ready, starting to move again and making a dedication and opening your eyes. Cheryl, I saw you walking the other day on, I don't know, like I and something. Yeah. Maybe like 12th or 9th or I don't know, something like that.
On the 17th, probably. Maybe 17th.
Maybe.
I was probably walking home from school.
No, it was in the morning, like early.
Kind of, yeah.
And you were walking like right in front of my car at the crosswalk, but
Oh, really?
I didn't want to honk because I thought it would probably really scare you.
I was walking the best. I always wonder if someone sees me, but I know. Just walking down the
street. All right. It's so weird. I updated my Firefox, and now when I expand the browser window, it goes to full screen every time, which I really don't like, and I don't know why it does that. Okay, so let's start with review. So we're on class 5. Of the Bodhisattva Vows, Becoming a Spiritual Warrior. And it's Wednesday, February 7th, 2018. We're going to go over vows 10 through 18. Okay, what is the main text that we're studying? What's it called in English?
Highway for Bodhisattvas.
Yes. And it's written by?
Jason Kappa.
Yep. And what are his dates?
1857 to 1419.
Yep. And does anyone remember the Tibetan for the text?
Changchub Shung Lam.
Yep. Changchub Shung Lam. And then what's the Tibetan for the original text? It's two words.
Norbai Utrang. Utrang?
Utrang, yep. And what's that one called in English?
String of Shining Jewels.
String of Shining Jewels by who? Yep. Geshe Sewon Samdro. So, Jason Kappa's. He goes into all the difficult fine points, and then Geshe Sewon Samdrup, he gives a more succinct presentation. And I talked, I emailed her, and I asked her the question that we were talking about, where you don't lose your bodhisattva vows lifetime to lifetime, so does that mean that you're breaking them all the time, and... you know, basically you're screwed. And what did she say last night?
She said that because most of it is intent, and if you don't remember, then you don't have an intent to be breaking vows. So it's only once you renew your vows that then you would be breaking them. And that I'd asked about, well, we thought that there might be a potential that you would remember. And she said maybe tulkus or some of those may remember, but more than likely it's just that they have that spiritual memory to where they act that way without even needing to be taught.
Yeah. So. Yep. That's basically what she said. Yeah, she said there's a text that says taking bodhisattva vows is like wearing an invisible cloak from that point on. And since since 99% of karma is intention, the answer is we don't break them. Which makes sense, and in theory, we could have come to that because we've studied all those things, but...
Yeah, she did say that if we've taken them before, we're more likely to have the inclination when we come across them to want to take them again.
Mm. That's cool. All right. Okay. All right, so vow number 10 is destroying a village, etc., city or a county or a country. So the motivation in this one is to want to destroy those places based upon the three poisons, which are, who knows the three poisons? Attachment, aversion, or ignorance.
Oh, yeah.
I get confused with these two because I think there's maybe different lists of three. That's what it seems like. Because there's attachment, aversion, ignorance. Yeah. So anyways, the et cetera here, which I think we have in quotes or in parentheses there, stands for a city, a large area like a county, and then a whole country. So how many vows are in this one? Mm-hmm. So there's really four root vows here. So I don't know if I'll give it to you at the end of this. I could, but... if or when you take your bodhisattva vows, you'll get the list or the little cards with all the vows. So those will be broken out. Like this one will be four different ones. I think this one's broken out. So anyways, there's really four root vows here. And a lot of these vows, and especially the secret teachings, were made for really busy people. They're mostly made for royalty and higher caste who, you know, like kings and that sort of thing, who didn't really have that much time and needed a shortcut or, you know, like a fast path, something like that. And so that's the type of person that could really break this vow, is like a king could break this vow, or... you know, like the president, or I guess really anyone who's like attacking another village, country, city, county, etc. But in this day and age, it would be the military too.
Are fascists?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that goes to supporting war. Yeah, that's why, I don't remember, maybe it's in the Karma course, but that's why we talk about emailing, I guess it's your congresswoman or congressman, and saying, I don't agree with any of my taxes going towards war. Like, you're not going to, there's also vows or, you know, ideas where you're not supposed to break the law if you're living in a culture, you're supposed to go by the rules of that culture. So you wouldn't just stop paying your taxes. That wouldn't be like the instruction. But you would send an email or something and say, I don't approve of my taxes going towards anything to do with war. That sort of thing. And then that shields you from that karma. Because otherwise, I believe it said that it's the same... it's the same karmic seed for like a taxpayer as it is for someone on the front lines who's shooting somebody. So it's, you know, it's karma's one of the deeply hidden teachings that only the Buddhas really see. So that one doesn't necessarily make that much sense to me, that it would be the same karmic power. But that's what the teachings have been that I've gotten. Yeah. So mainly we don't have the opportunity to do this one, which is really good. So Jay Tsongkhapa says, in this, the motivation is that you want to destroy those places because of desire or hatred or ignorance. So that would be the motivation here, destroying those places for those reasons. And it has to be afflicted emotion or afflicted motivation in order to break this vow. So this doesn't include striking the people in those places, because we've already covered that in the other vow about striking another person. So these types of vows where we don't have the means to break them are great. And there's a few of them like this. They're kind of freebies. So when you come through these, you can still think in concentric circles, like I'll think about recycling or things that I'm not doing to save the environment that I could, or that's usually what I think of with this vow. So you can think in larger concentric circles, but then don't confuse not recycling with breaking this vow, because that's not that. And after you keep them for a long time, you'll kind of forget. So it's really good if this course is offered again, to take it again when it's offered. Because I look at these all the time, and I keep my book, and I didn't remember a lot of these things from when I studied it the first time. There's, like, over time you kind of start to think that you might be breaking some of them, but you're probably really not. It's just like you're losing clarity of what all the vows really mean. And then you have, you know, all the audio and the online backup information on the ACI Dharma website, so you can look back over them as well. And I used to do that more. I should start doing that again. Okay. All right, so number 11, teaching emptiness to those who are not prepared. And this one on the surface seems as though it could be really easy to break. But like a lot of the vows we've gone over, it's really specific. And you'll find that others in the Buddhist community, in the American Buddhist community, think it's wrong to teach anyone emptiness, or anyone who's not totally into it, or that sort of thing. And that's not what this vow is. So if you just read the name of it, you get a misconception of what it is. So the point at which you break the root vow is very specific, and these are the qualifications. So the qualities of a person you should not teach emptiness to. Number one, or A, they have not studied emptiness carefully. B, your description of emptiness would scare them. C, they have wishing bodhicitta. In some form, they have the intention to reach full awakening for the sake of other beings. And then, on top of that, what must occur in order for you to break this vow is that they would A, get scared, B, give up the Mahayana, and C, take up Hinayana as a result of your emptiness teaching. So it's kind of a lot of things that have to happen there. The person has to have studied emptiness carefully. Your description of it would scare them. They have to have bodhicitta in some form. And then as a result of you teaching them, they get scared, give up Mahayana, and they go to Hinayana. That's what's needed to break this vow completely. And he doesn't talk about it, but my thinking is that it would be teaching in any form. not just formally. So even just like talking to a friend or a family member or someone about it. I mean, they would have to be, they would still have to have those qualities. So maybe more like talking to a Dharma brother or sister, unless your friends and family are also studying.
So, for example, if I put society on this all the time, when talking with friends about the pen,
mm-hmm.
teaching, basically, is that
mm-hmm.
I won't be able to do that anymore?
Well, do you think, do they have bodhicitta in some form, you think?
Yeah, in some form, yes. Maybe another religion bodhicitta. But.
And is your description scaring them? I tend to think that the pen's pretty safe because it's actually not the ultimate idea of emptiness. It's more the mind-only school. It's still saying that, like, the object's still here.
Mm-hmm.
So the pen teaching, from what I've seen, is pretty gentle. But they would have to be, it sounds like they would have to be on the Mahayana path. Which, in this sense, I take to mean Tibetan Buddhist Mahayana path,
uh-huh.
not just like the idea of bodhicitta in some way. That's how I'm taking this vow. So I don't think so, because it's also saying they would get scared, give up Mahayana, and go and study Hinayana.
Oh, okay.
So there's a lot of stipulations there. So probably A would apply that they haven't studied emptiness carefully, mm-hmm. I would guess. You said it doesn't seem to scare them. And it also in my notes on C it says you're teaching them the ultimate meaning of pure emptiness. And the pen isn't the ultimate meaning. It gets at it. But it's not the.
I think it's a wonderful way to describe emptiness.
It is. It's really helpful.
At least, or kind of like rest.
Yep. And all of us, as we go through our spiritual career, it's helpful. Well, we study all the different ideas of emptiness in these courses we do, and in the Geshe course of Tibetan Buddhism, they study all the forms of emptiness because you need all of them at some point. We use all of them at some point. And most of us don't just live in the highest idea of emptiness, that everything is a projection, not just part of it coming from me and then part of it coming from the object out there.
Okay.
So it is. It's very helpful. Every idea of emptiness in Buddhism is really helpful. And they're not all the galupa ultimate idea of emptiness at the same time. So they're just both of those things. They're helpful, and not all of them are the ultimate emptiness. So I think the way Geshe Michael presents that one is really genius.
Is there another way to explain emptiness besides the pen?
Like a set, kind of like routine like that, like
uh-huh,
the pen?
Yes.
There probably is, but I don't know another like set routine. There's many different ways of talking about it,
uh-huh.
but not any that I've seen like that I think it's really amazing the way you put it together, that are so like easy to understand for anybody. Because emptiness is really a confusing subject when you dive into it deeper and deeper. But also to be able to,
scary when you describe it, yeah, like if you go deeper and deeper, like saying you're a projection and your higher self is a projection and everything is a projection.
Right.
And then it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it can be, for sure. So, no, I don't think that what you're explaining would be breaking this vow.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I am reborn in a lower level, it was Heather's fault.
So all of these vows that we're talking about, they were spread out through all different scriptures, and then Jaitsangapa is like struggling to clean them up and put them all together. So he also says, it seems from all these different texts that if you really check out the person carefully and you think they're ready, and then they still give up Mahayana as a result of your teaching, then you didn't break the vow. So there's also that. Some people think if, like we mentioned before, if you teach emptiness at all, you break your bodhisattva vow. That's not the case, as we can see. It's like very specific. Or, oh, you know what? In this class, Geshe Michael mentioned this too. Or if you teach a non-Buddhist, you break the vow, and he says that's not the case. So it is, as we were mentioning before, it is only if it's a Mahayana Buddhist that you're talking to.
Okay.
And then because of your teaching, they freak out, they leave Mahayana, they go study Hinayana.
Okay.
Yeah. So teaching emptiness to someone who's not Mahayana and freaking them out is not a good thing, but it's not breaking the vow. You know, in general, you don't really want to freak anybody out about emptiness. Okay. Next one. Number 12 is to turn someone back from total enlightenment. But is that a lemur?
I think so.
That's what I thought when I saw it. Yeah, he's cute. Looks stressed out. Okay, so total enlightenment, why do we use total enlightenment? We've talked about this before, but isn't enlightenment enlightenment? And the answer is that two Hinayana nirvanas are sometimes called Buddhahood. So that's why we use the total. And it can be really confusing if you're at a different group or listening to a different lineage's talk, because they'll be talking about something and using the same words, but you can tell that they're not meaning it the same way. So that this is one of those cases. So the two Hinayana nirvanas, they'll call Buddhahood sometimes, which is confusing because we have a different definition of it. So the person you turn back from total enlightenment must be a person who does have the wish for enlightenment already. They have some intention to reach Buddhahood for all living beings. You must turn someone back from the Mahayana by telling them they won't be able to practice the six perfections and so should follow the Hinayana path of seeing emptiness and following the four Arya truths to Nirvana. So basically, you're saying bodhisattva activities are beyond you. You might as well just give up and go study this other way of Buddhism. So it's really messed up. I don't think any of us would ever do this, but
like jealousy or something like that, Liz, or it's just,
it doesn't mention anything about the intention.
So we must,
it's just like it seems like pride. It seems like I can follow this path, but you might as well just give up. There's no way you're going to make it. That's kind of the sense I get from it, but it doesn't say that specifically. It could be like you're jealous of the person, you just don't want him around or something. I can't imagine a good intention for saying that, you know? Any intention for saying that, I think, would have to be pretty negative.
know sometimes the guidance, like somebody gives you guidance and you know what you know, and then I don't know, it could be a suggestion. But I guess it has to be more with not like encouraging people who is interested in just kind of like, keep going.
Yeah.
No, wait. Okay.
So, who does anyone have an idea why would it be a bad thing to tell someone to give up Mahayana, you can't handle it, go and study Hinayana, and, you know, the path of the Four Noble Truths, attain Nirvana, but, like, this other path is just too much for you. What's the problem with that?
They may reach Nirvana, but not under the influence of bodhicitta.
Which means that they wouldn't
reach total enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. So you would be entaining. It's not even a word. You would be what's the word I'm looking for? Delaying. You'd be delaying their enlightenment.
Oh, okay.
So you'd basically just be setting them back. Because you know you can reach Nirvana on the Mahayana path too, under the influence of bodhicitta. And this point actually confuses me because I've studied with Geshe Michael for so long. But I remember Ami saying that the way Geshe Michael teaches it, it sounds like you just go right to Buddhahood when you have bodhicitta. But if I'm remembering correctly, she said it's not actually true. You do go to Buddhahood, but you do go to Nirvana first, too. So I'm a little fuzzy on it, but that might just be confusing things more. But basically, trying to think of another example of it.
It's like Monopoly. Like, you can go past Go or whatever and collect. Like,
yeah, it's kind of like giving someone, ambushing someone, or like saying, no, you go over there when you know, like, that maybe they're going to lose the game, or
like deterring them, or yeah. Throwing them off.
Yeah, it's like you're both maybe like vying for the same job and you encourage them to do something that you know is going to like destroy their chances of getting the job and then you'll get the job. It kind of has like that flavor of it, you know? You're like pushing them off into something that's not going to be as good for them, you know, from what you can tell. So mainly what Belinda said at first is the reason, because they will reach Nirvana, which is the permanent cessation of mental afflictions, brought on by individual analysis, which is direct perception of emptiness. But it is not Buddhahood. So you're sending them to a path where they're not going to reach Buddhahood in this life. Well, at some point, but you're delaying their progress. So that's why it would be a negative thing to start with. So what would have to happen is you tell them the Mahayana path is too hard to follow a lesser path, and they actually listen to you, and they give up Mahayana, and they go to a different path. So that's all that has to happen there. And I could see kind of getting to this, maybe if you get frustrated with someone, like you see, you've been practicing with someone for a while and you see them just like not doing anything or seeming to be not doing anything. And then maybe out of like frustration or something, you say something like that to them. So I could see that it's possible that it could happen, you know, but knowing that this vow, they would have to listen to you and they would have to give up the Mahayana as well. But this one doesn't seem that hard to me to do. Or for, like, the situation to come up. Especially if it's, like, a good friend or a partner or someone that you see a lot. And maybe you're just irritated with, like, you want them to be doing something. Or I don't know, you see that they're not meditating as much as you think they should or something like that. And so maybe like out of anger or frustration, you just say, you know what, you're not going to get anywhere in this path. You should just do the other. So I can see kind of how this one could come up. But it's through hearing these things over and over again that you'll never do them. That's my experience from all the teachings that I've heard. Even if sometimes you're not sure yet why you're not doing them, it'll just be ingrained and you just never will. Okay, let's go to the next one. Isn't this one cute? So, what slide is this? We already did that one. Okay, convincing others to give up their pratimoksha or freedom vows. These were the 8 types of vows that we talked about. So freedom vows are the vows that lead to individual freedom for yourself. So that would be nirvana, or on the Hinayana path. And you can do this with someone who has taken the vows and is keeping them well. Normally it'd be an ordained person, and they're keeping them quite well. They're happy with them. It doesn't have to be an ordained person. But you get them to give up by telling them to come over to Mahayana and that they don't need the freedom vows because Mahayana is all that they need. So we all know that that is not true. We've gone over it many times that you have to keep all of your morality. You don't just throw away the others as you get more vows. So it's not like you take the Bodhisattva vows and then all the other vows that you have are just null. Or you're done with them. So that's what you would be saying here. You say you don't need the freedom vows. Mahayana is all you need. And you get them to give up those vows. So as we've gone over, keeping our morality is the basis for keeping the Bodhisattva vows and for them working and for all the teachings afterwards to work, for all the higher teachings to work. And I think sometimes, I'm not so sure that these always have to, like, not all of them talk about intention. Some of them do talk about, like it has to be out of ignorance or anger, something like that, pride. These don't talk about that sort of intention. So it could just be, this wouldn't be as strong of an intention. Would this be right? But I think it could just be that you're just kind of like making something up and you're acting like, and telling people that they don't need to keep those vows and just keep the Mahayana vows. Like maybe you've gotten tiny bits of teachings or something. That wouldn't be any of us in this room because you've all had a lot of background and teachings up to this point. So you would never do that. But maybe someone who's not very well trained, they could break this one that way. It's kind of like just making up teachings, really. Or maybe you had a teacher who told you that and you just don't know that it's not true. That's not any of us because we're talking about it and we know. But that's a way that I could see you might be able to do this one. All right, next one. You mean, what's the title of the vow?
Or like the
acceptance? Oh, the lifetime lay.
Okay.
Yeah, the five of the lifetime lay vows. Yes. And I think that, so the freedom vows are the ones that lead to individual freedom. And if I'm remembering correctly, those are all the vows up until the Bodhisattva vows. Because, you know, the Pratimoksha would include, I think it includes like the 10 non-virtues. But I know it includes refuge and the lifetime lay. So those would all be the vows of individual freedom. And then when you get to the Bodhisattva vows, that's when there's the bodhicitta in there.
Okay.
So these all have that same sort of flavor of putting down the other teachings or kind of steering someone in the wrong way. And this one does too. You're disparaging the Hinayana, the study of the Four Noble Truths of the listeners or the self-made Buddhas, by saying that you can't reach Nirvana by following the Hinayana. So what's wrong with that? That statement. You can, yeah. That's the culmination of those paths. That's what it gets you. So the listener track, we talked about this last week too. The typical teaching is the Four Noble Truths. The self-made Buddhas, in this life, they don't have a teacher, but for thousands and thousands of years, they did have a teacher. And the Buddha part of the self-made Buddhas means that they're looking to reach a lower enlightenment, which would be Nirvana. So you're striving to end your own suffering in that sort of track, and you aren't doing it to help all beings. That's the Hinayana track. And they call it the lower schools. You can call them that. But then it kind of sets it up in our mind where, like, our school's better. But my sense is that every school kind of does that. And in a way, it's really helpful to think that your school is the best because you're in that school and you're devoting your life to that school. But it's also called the path shared, and it's called the paths that are shared because we study all of them. It's not like Hinayana path is completely separate. So we're studying the entire path in all these courses. And in our center too. It's not like every teaching is purely Mahayana teaching. It's not. It's a mix of everything. And I haven't been to enough other centers or spent time in other lineages to know if they do that as well.
I heard a Hinayana teaching recently, and I can't remember if it was on emptiness or I can't remember. But there was kind of like that same feeling of like, and this is why this is the way to look at it, and like kind of like implying that like if you look at it the Mahayana way or the way that you're kind of missing out on this like flavor of it. Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So were they presenting the Mahayana way too, or just...
No.
That's my sense of what I've seen, which honestly is very little because I've mostly just studied in this lineage and I haven't wanted to go anywhere else. But the few that I've heard, they seem to be purely that lineage.
Mm-hmm.
And Geshe Michael mentions in this course too that Tibetan Buddhism... I don't know if it's exclusively, but studies all of the lineage of Buddhism. And he said that in the monastery they spend tons of time on the Hinayana path. And we've spent lots of courses on the Hinayana path. So it's all things that we study. We study all of it. But in our school we do it is believed that ultimately we need that that highest view of emptiness, and that and bodhicitta is indispensable. That is another part of our path, which is why there's reasons why we're all attracted to this sort of path too. So we like that idea of helping all beings, and we're not just looking for helping just ourselves. Even though we probably think that we are, because most of the time we feel like it, but we're not if we even have that attraction to it. We're just not, and we don't have anything to compare it to anyways. So we can think that we're really selfish, but we're only comparing to other ideas in our mind, and maybe what we see other people doing, but we don't know what's in their mind unless we can read their mind. So I think that's kind of what we were talking about last week, where you like flip into being too hard on yourself, which in a way is just another way of thinking about ourselves more. And I think kind of derailing our practice in a certain way too. So the more we can just like let go of those things, seems to me that it clears the way for more spiritual progress. But it is progress going from blaming other people to then maybe blaming ourselves more. And then from there we like even out and yeah. Okay. Let's see where we are. So as we said, in the Hinayana path, you're striving to end your own suffering, and you aren't doing it to help all beings. And the thing is, in the Hinayana track, you will end your own suffering, but you're still going to need to go on anyways to reach full enlightenment, to become a Buddha. So for this vow, you'd say no matter how much you study those Hinayana teachings, you cannot remove your mental afflictions in their entirety. And that's completely false. That's what nirvana is. So the vow is broken when they hear and understand your statement. So if you tell this to a dog or a cat or another animal, you don't break the root vow. They have to be able to understand you. And apparently this is very common. So I think it is very common actually, because in a way it's just the language that we use, and we live in a society where it's good and bad, right and wrong. So we think that if we're saying our lineage or our study is right, that means the other's wrong. But it doesn't have to mean that. We just live in this duality where it's either right or wrong, and there's no other thing. There's no other option. So just because this path is right, we can say it's right for us. We can say it's just right, period. It doesn't mean that the other's wrong. The others have really great, amazing things to offer, and a lot of people are attracted to those that wouldn't be attracted to the Mahayana path, because it's a very specific type of person that's attracted to the Kalupa lineage. It's very academic, and other lineages, from my understanding, think that the idea of emptiness that our lineage has is just like crazy. So they all have their different ideas. And from what I've heard, the arguments they have are based on incorrect understanding of what we think of emptiness. So, anyways, okay. Let's see if we missed anything else. Yeah, this is what Geshe-Michael says in this class. He says, You should know that in Tibet they study the Hinayana teachings more deeply than in any other country. And all of the teachings were spoken by the Buddha. So they're all beautiful. They're all the Buddha's teaching. And the people who took the Karma course, we all know this because we got a good dose of the Abhidharma Kosha. Let's see what page we're on. I think we can take a break. Does anyone have any questions? Okay. Let's see. A break. We like five. Okay. Okay. So we're on 14 and a half. So this vow is left out because it duplicates the first one. Praising yourself and putting down others. But there's more detail in this one, which is why it's good to know. So you must be a person who is teaching, studying, or reciting Mahayana texts. And you say something to someone that you're not doing these things for praise or gain, but this other person is. So it's like, I'm teaching this class and I'm not doing it for any praise or gain for myself. But that teacher on Tuesday, that's what they're doing. Or whoever's teaching Thursday or Saturday, you know, whatever day, that other teacher, they're doing that. So you say that someone else is undertaking a bodhisattva activity for personal gain and that you aren't a bodhisattva for that reason. They're doing it for personal gain, but not me. It's accusing another person of teaching, studying, or reciting teachings for bad reasons. So to create a split amongst Buddhists is the most serious deed that you can do. And if you hear anyone going there, stop them so you can help each other. And it seems to be, this is Jetsangkhapa, according to most texts, that what you say needs to be a lie. And you say this with the motivation of personal gain or reputation or recognition.
Only within the Buddha, when talking about teaching, or
it sounds like a
not like in the outside world of like at work or
yeah, it's saying someone with Mahayana motivation is teaching Buddhism and they're dissing someone else with the same motivation teaching Buddhism, saying that they're just doing it for personal gain. They just want money. They just want to be famous. They just want students or offerings or I don't know what else. They want to feel important, but I'm doing it for the right reason. So yeah, it specifies that it's Mahayana person talking about Mahayana person. And Jetsangkhapa said that probably Master Shantideva chose not to list this vow because this one is completely equal to the first one, according to him. The motivation is jealousy or attention and honor from other people. So this closely duplicates vow number one, but it's from another sutra source, and it's a little bit different. It's basically a specific instance of vow number one. So the motivation must be jealousy for the honor or gain that another person is getting. So all of these deeds, they're evil things. They have an ugly or harmful motivation. It's not just that if you ever say something bad about someone that you're breaking this vow. That could be like the concentric circle that's out here compared to where breaking the vow would be. So, you know, it's like spitting in the face of someone who comes to you in their last desperate hope for help and you say no. It's not just teaching emptiness to someone who's not quite ready. It's getting them to give up the Mahayana path completely because you totally freak them out. So when we're at work and we praise ourselves and put someone else down, it's not breaking our bodhisattva vows. It's not planting a great seed either, but it's not breaking our vows. So it's good to know the difference. So we have to be very careful, because until we can read someone else's mind, we don't know their motivation for anything. So one of the best teachings is just not to judge any other people. Just don't do it. Just leave it alone. And there's something, at least for me, I must have the seeds for this, or maybe it's just a human nature thing. But there's something so juicy about talking about other people and judging them. There really is. And it's like so alluring. But it's planting really bad seeds for us in the future. And it seems to be the way that a lot of people connect in our society, at least from what I see.
I think at least in our American culture, I mean,
yeah,
it's all about, you know, like A news and entertainment and what's the latest going on. And so it always seems like it's very gossip centered.
Mm-hmm.
And with that gossip is generally, you know, critiquing, judging.
Right. Yeah, it's like the great American pastime. And maybe it's like that in other countries. I don't know. I don't live in them. It might be like that, but it does. It seems like it's like that here. Yeah, especially, I don't know. It's almost like we have nothing better to do at a certain time or something like that, and so we just go and do that because we're used to it. It's like a societal norm. It's sort of like you're just bored, so you just start talking about people, or
I think we can live vicariously through what they do or their success.
Yeah, and then if they fall in some way, then we're like secretly happy about it, and we talk about it with other people, and like, yeah, it's really twisted. So it's completely the opposite of bodhicitta. Wanting to reach full awakening for the sake of others. It's like they're all our only children. I guess maybe people do gossip about their kids, but if you like loved your only children, you know, so much, you probably wouldn't go around like talking crap about them. I don't, you know, like I guess you could, but the idea of it is that you love and you care for them so much and you would just do anything that you could. Probably, at least when they're a baby, you're not going to like go around talking crap about them. Did you see what that little jerk did yesterday? Because they can't even talk or anything. They're just like totally dependent on you. So maybe that's a more helpful way to think of it. You know, all of these beings are, we're all in the same boat, too. We're in that river rushing towards our death. None of us can get out. None of us are getting out alive. We're all in it together, and we're feeding into this divisive speech, this way of, like, really just wasting our precious life that we have, this opportunity that we have to practice and study. So it's just creating poison in our world. And the sick thing about it is that we're attracted to it.
That's right, yeah.
You what?
For me, it's like this anger. Lately, it's manifesting in this anger. And then it just builds up so much, and then I feel like I have to get it out, and it doesn't matter who I'm getting it out to. Sometimes it's the totally wrong person, or I shouldn't even be saying anything. And then how do you even? You know, I mean, you know it's wrong.
So you have, like, things happen with someone else that bring up a lot of anger for you, and then it gets to the point where you're, like, so pissed that you just talk about it to somebody.
That you don't even trust.
Yeah.
You can't even. happens a lot for me at school. And then there's a lot of people doing it around me, like talking crap left and right, just all kinds
of
crap. And I'm just like trying to stay to myself. And then sometimes I think today I just got really overwhelmed with this person I was working with, trying to have compassion, trying to have empathy for this person because they're new, they don't have a good grasp on what they're doing. And I'm trying to be patient, trying to be all these things, and to treat them like I would want to be treated because I was there. And I still am sometimes. But then it's like, getting angry at them because I end up doing all the thing. I end up doing the whole thing all day long with their client that they brought in, and the client is making all these comments about, oh, look at all the work that you did to him. And I'm like, and then taking pictures at the end of the day, being like, oh my God, it looks so amazing, look what you did, all this stuff. And then like these people walk by and I'm leaving and I hear them say like, oh, your hair is amazing. Who did it? And then the girl's like, him. He did all of it. And I'm like, oh my God. And then I just hit the fan. You know, it was just like that. You know?
Yeah.
Where you just...
you just, like, can't handle anymore.
But you know that it had brought... that this is happening because... you did this, but then it's, and then it's like, and then it makes it harder to even like get out of this.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds very frustrating, and it sounds like you're struggling against like self-cherishing and like you're struggling against all those afflictions that are coming up. That the teachings that I've heard is that's a really powerful thing to be doing. A lot more powerful than when things are just going smoothly for us, because there's, you know, it's like easy to be kind and caring when everything's going your way. And then when it's not, that's when the real work sets in. And we have those ups and downs, so, you know, we don't go off the deep end. But it sounds like you're struggling against it, which is really good. So it's good. You're trying to practice and you're trying to do what you think is right. And then from this situation that happened, maybe it informs like how you want to interact with the person next time. Like, but thinking of it from what's going to be the best for them. What's the best thing I can do for them? And maybe, I don't really know, but maybe the best thing that you can do for them is to, like, you can give them tips, but let him do it on his own.
He just couldn't. Oh, my God. No, he could not. He couldn't even stand for his head. He couldn't. Like, and I'm just thinking, why is he in this profession? And trying not to think, you know, it's just like you're spraying that hose just in one place. And then just talking, like.
Oh. Yeah.
I kind of asked Ami something about this sometimes, and like babbling that, and she was saying that like, that it's kind of a lack of like being able to like engage in the moment in like compassion for yourself too, like because you're not or like for me, like I'm not like connecting to like the hurt and the like maybe feelings of like betrayal or like all of those things. So like for me, anger is very accessible, and then I just like hang out there because I, and then like especially when I don't want to go deeper or whatever. But that really helped me when she said that, like seeing it as like an opportunity to like connect with like I'll even see it as like me as like a little girl or something, and like, oh my gosh, yeah, that is so hard. Like, he doesn't even know how to shampoo, and you know, you're stressed about your day as well, and now you're thinking about
That's good.
I know. I believe it's Master Shantideva who says, if you get to that point where you know you're going to like do something that you really don't want to do, then you just act like, I think he says like, does he say a bump on a log? You act like a stick, I think he says. You just completely freeze. So like if you know, oh my gosh, I'm going to do something I really don't want to do, you like completely freeze. Or as Geshe Michael always says, go to the bathroom. Like no one questions. He says it's like the holy bathroom. Nobody questions if you have to go to the bathroom. No one's going to say, no, you can't. I mean, unless, I guess you're in a class where the teacher does that. But usually the bathroom is a place that you can go. So if you reach that point, maybe just, I have to go to the bathroom. It doesn't matter what you're doing. When you have to go to the bathroom, no one's going to say, no, you can't go. You just say, I got to go to the bathroom. But I think it sounds like you're doing good, though. You're trying. You're, like, struggling against those things, which is planting really strong seeds. And it's really hard. My last work environment was really gossipy. And I thought I was not participating in it at all. But I realize now that I was. Because I wasn't doing it as much as anyone else, but I was just surrounded by that all the time. And so it was kind of like infecting me, you know? And now I realize, because my work environment now, there's, from what I can tell, there's like virtually no gossip, which is amazing. And I can see my tendency now that I have from, that I had from before, but that was kind of like strengthened in my last work environment. So it is, it's really hard to be surrounded by that all the time and to not get stuck in it or sucked in. Especially because it's like we want to, in a way. It's like exciting and juicy sometimes.
I'm really quick before we go.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we're talking about ourselves. No, I have a karma that I'm dealing with right now, which is in the past I never liked, it's not that I didn't like new people. I just didn't like to train new people. So I was always avoided that. And now I come to this new job and nobody wants to train me. Can I shadow you? And not right now.
Oh.
I don't like this. And then I think about all the time. Like,
yeah.
Yes, I was like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now it's coming back like big. Nobody. I told everybody, can I shadow you? No. Okay.
How are you supposed to learn?
So I'm working on patience. I start getting mad at them, and then I remember, but I was like that. Just exactly like that. They would ask me, can I shadow you? Maybe later. And then,
so. That's good that you're able to look at it karmically.
I see that. And but at the time, I was like, this is not creating bad karma because they can be trained by somebody else. And I'm not a trainer, and I don't really know how to teach. So They can do it themselves. And my parents were like that, I think. Like, you want to learn something, you do it yourself. Kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just do it yourself. You'll learn faster. But it's me just telling myself that I didn't want to do it. I was lazy. Take the time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm struggling with it. It's a case of instant karma.
I know. It sucks when it comes back. Okay. I think it's helpful, though, if you can rejoice in Cheryl helping and training the person she was working with, like that'll help plant the opposite seeds.
Say that again.
If you rejoice because Cheryl was helping to train that person, So rejoice in her doing that. That'll help you plant the opposite seeds of what's coming up.
Okay, I'll think about that tonight.
Or whenever you see someone training someone, think, oh, that's so great. I know that. I know that thing. There's kind of that thing when someone's new, like, you're just like, eh.
I feel it right now. They're going to look at me like, oh, my God. This
yeah, I know. Okay. Let's go on to the next one. This is to say a lie about the profound. So for this one, there must be another person there whom you're talking to, and they grasp what you're saying. That's kind of a theme with a lot of these. The lie you say is as follows, which is really messed up. So you're lying here, okay? I have seen emptiness, which is not true. And I like you, and if you do what I say, you will see emptiness too. That's the whole idea behind this. It's like a salesperson who's lying, and you're saying, just because I like you, I'm going to give you this special deal. And then when they grasp your words, they just have to grasp the words. That's when you've broken them out. So, I mean, I don't think any of us are going to do this. But they're here for a reason. So it's good to know it. And most of the time, this one would be like a freebie, you know? But what is that vow to? I can't remember. It might be coming up, or maybe it's the refuge vows. I'm probably remembering it slightly incorrectly. But it's like to lie about.
About your practice?
Yeah, to lie about something, even in jest. Dang, I can't remember. Yeah, maybe it is. So that one, that seems to kind of, no, it wouldn't be the same thing. This one, you're definitely lying. You're saying, I've seen emptiness. I think maybe a concentric circle would be like if you're kidding. But I think that's another vow that's coming up, so we'll get to that one. So for this one, again, I've seen emptiness. Not true. I like you. Do what I say, and you'll see emptiness too. Which is really messed up because you haven't seen emptiness. So you can't guide them there if you haven't been there yourself. You know, like, you can guide them through the teachings, but you're misleading them. So it's really, you're just lying. So when they grasp the words, you've broken the vow. All right, next one, to accept the property of the three jewels. What is that on the bag? Is it? It's not a pound sign, is it?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh. I don't remember it like looking so much like an L.
Yeah.
So, for this one, to receive Dharma items taken or stolen from the three jewels. Stolen means anything dedicated to the use of the three jewels, such as food, books, money, etc. So for a monastery or a center. So we have a vow not to steal anything from the three jewels. This one is to accept stolen goods. Normally, the scenario would be like this. There's officials of a country who decide that they don't like one monastery and they like another monastery. So they put a tax on the first monastery and then they give the money to the other monastery. That would be breaking this vow.
Only related to the, I mean, not other.
Right, not stealing other things. Just This one's for anything dedicated to spiritual use. So it seems to say any religion. But it says, but then he goes on to say a monastery, a center, etc. My understanding, I think it's specifically towards Buddhism. But I can't say for sure on that one. And then, like, other, this is just my thinking, other centers or religions would be, like, slightly outside. Of course, it's not a good thing, but maybe not breaking this vow. But he doesn't specify that. I'm not sure why I have that impression. So you don't have to steal it with your own hands. You can send someone else to get the things. Most of these, yeah, I mean, I think my understanding, most of these are applying specifically to Buddhism and a lot of them to Mahayana practice. So it would be kind of like concentric circle. Like what was the one we were talking about before? Oh, to teaching someone emptiness and then they freak out. They leave Mahayana. So that one's like specifically Mahayana practitioners. This one doesn't specify, but it says monastery, etc. All right. Number 17 is to institute a bad rule. When making rules for Dharma practitioners, you take away the possessions of the meditators because they don't have enough scriptural knowledge, or so you think, and you give the possessions to those who are studying scripture. So in a monastery and in a Dharma group, you'll have certain people who are attracted to meditation and long retreat, and then you have others who are really attracted to the study side of it. And if you walk into a monastery, or maybe even into a center, you can get the wrong idea that the meditators are lazy, and those who can recite everything are working harder. So you go to the meditators' rooms, you take their things, and you give them to the studiers who seem to be working harder. So you break the vow when you take the meditator's goods.
Unless they're giving it away for you.
Yeah, that would be different. Mm-hmm. This would be like you're just taking it. Yeah. And there's this story, we have to be careful of this idea. There's a story of Master Shantideva, who everyone in the monastery called Mr. Three Thoughts, because they said all he seemed to do was think about eating, sleeping, pooping. Those were his three thoughts. Those were only his only concerns. And so to get rid of him, the monks decided they were going to ask him to give the monthly lecture, the monthly Dharma lecture. And he agreed, and he walked into the teaching hall where all the monks are gathered, and they made the throne so high that nobody could get up there, thinking that he'd make a fool of himself and, you know, everybody would laugh at him or whatever. And he walked up to the front, and I think the details go like he like touched the ground, and then immediately he was just up on top of the throne, and everyone was like, wow. And he taught. He asked if they wanted to hear something original or if they wanted to hear a teaching that they'd already heard before. And they were like, oh, we'll hear something original. Like, what is he going to teach us? And he started teaching the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. And he got to the 9th chapter, which is on wisdom, which is so profound that he started flying up into the air. And there were a few monks who had that same power, and so they went with him as far as they could. And he went higher and higher, and then he completely flew off, and he never went back to the monastery. And the monks found him, and they asked him to come back, but he said no because he saw that it would be more beneficial for him to stay where he was. But they told him that the rest of the text, the Bodhisattva Acharya Avatar, was in the rafters of his room so they could find it there. So this is, can think of this story basically for not judging any of your fellow practitioners. It's not an easy thing not to do. We're just used to doing that. So remembering we can't read anyone's mind, we don't know where they are in their practice.
Emotions just pop up.
Yeah, which isn't, you're not planting the seed just by the emotion or the thought coming up. That's like a ripening from the past. So when you, yeah, then when you swallow it and you start thinking again, like, yeah, you know, they act like they're practicing, but they're not really. I've never seen them doing anything. When you follow it and you perpetuate it, then that's planting the new seed. Just with the thought or feeling coming up, you can just watch it come up and then just let, then it just goes on its own. So that's the ripening of the past seed, which you can think of as like a purification too. So that's not planting another bad seed right there. But if you engage in it and like move it along again, then you're planting the same seed again. So basically with this vow, both are very good, the study and the meditators. You don't want all one or the other. And so don't judge other people's practice. I think I see this even here. You think people are better students who can answer questions. Like, oh, they know the answer to that question. They must be a really good practitioner. And then maybe someone who's more quiet, you think, oh, they know nothing. And maybe their practice is more meditation. Or maybe they do know all the answers. They just are more quiet in class or, you know. And it's important for both. It's important to know the answers, too. But to not diss the people who are more into the meditation side. Okay. So the motivation for this one. So the thing that you take has to be anything that they enjoy and that they own that you're taking from the meditators. And the motivation is dislike, anger, or hatred. The bad deed is not committed by the people whom the things are given to. It's by those who had the idea to take them away. That's who's doing the bad deed. So when we're checking our vow book, which we can go over more at a certain point if you guys want to in this course. If you're checking it 6 times a day and you're normally just, you're going to be checking for how close you come just to make sure that you never actually get there. And if you're coming close, it's a negative thing that you're doing anyway, so it's a chance to purify. But you're keeping the vows in mind and you're keeping them fresh and you're not forgetting. And while the vows are fresh, you can review the actual meaning of the vow and what it takes to break it too. I think that's a really good idea to do with the book. You should start doing that too. Okay. Last one. Giving up aspiring bodhicitta. So this is basically like the whole thing. You're giving up the frame of mind wanting to help all beings. You personally decide you don't want to become enlightened to benefit others. You give this up and say, I'm not going to help all sentient beings. And Jason Kappa says you can only commit this one for 1 second. The next moment, after you have that thought, you're no longer a bodhisattva. You say, I'll no longer work for all sentient beings. I give it up.
You just have to think about it and you lose everything.
No, it says you give it up and say. You say, I'm not going to help all sentient beings. But then it does say the next, but then he does say the next moment after you have the thought. Let me see. I don't know for sure with this one. If it has to be said out loud. The other ones that we've had have specified that it's not just the thought. It's saying it, but I don't know for sure.
What if you say it and then, no, I was just angry, whatever. I'm coming back.
I think you still broke it.
Oh, yeah?
Yep, but you can take the vows again, but they won't be the same as before. So this one's kind of like a quick breaking of it. But I don't know, it does, from what Geshe Michael taught, he does say you give it up and say, I'm not gonna help all sentient beings. But then he talks about having the thought a few times. So it seems to imply that it's either, but I can't say for sure.
But you mean you don't even have vows anymore, that you have to retake it from a teacher?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only vow within the vow that does that type of thing? Or if you break any of the other ones?
No, the other ones have a lot more stipulation to them. This one doesn't. The others have, like, you know, the person has to have A, B, and C, where this, and this needs to happen. And this one's just like, you've just, like, completely given up, and you're done. And so you've broken. You're no longer a bodhisattva after that. Does anyone remember what it is?
Being reborn in a lower realm.
Realm? Yes, that. And then what was the other one that you can't reach in this life?
Nirvana.
Yeah, the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, which is, does anyone remember what it is? It's seeing emptiness directly under the influence of bodhicitta. So you would not be able to do that in this life. That's all of these root vows when you break them. So for this one, you don't need the four chains to break this vow, which we're going to be going over. All of the others, you have to have the four chains to break them.
And then you've broken them as the same result, and it'll be the same result, or the same, you know, living in the lower realm next life.
Yeah. So you won't be able... You won't be able to reach the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, which basically means you won't be able to reach Buddhahood in this life. And I can't remember. There was, I don't know if it was just one or two of these. My computer's offline, so I can't check our other week's notes. But, I don't know if it was all of them or if it was talking about a specific vow, but I remember after I think it's after you break any of the root vows. When you die, you immediately take a birth in the lowest hell. But I'd have to double check that. So if there's questions that we didn't really answer, write them down for me or send them to me or something, and I'll look them up. Okay, let's see what else we didn't go over for this one. Actually, looking at this, I think that this one is talking about the thought or saying it.
The thought too?
I think so. But remind me, and I'll look into it and find out for sure. So this one and one other vow are two of the most serious. Do you remember which? Do you know which other one it would be?
It's the pride one. The one that.
Is it taking blood from the body?
Stealing.
It's like the most basic one that we would do, like, in theory, that we could do all the time.
The name that the Buddha's teaching, or the Dharma?
In a way, it's the wrong worldview.
Okay.
Which, so you don't need the four chains to break this vow or vow number 9. The wrong worldview is not believing in karma, that your actions have consequences. And not believing in past and future lives. So that it's that one. Saying that for sure, no, those things do not exist. So you don't need the four chains for both of those. So this vow and the other one are the worst ones to break. Okay. So you have all 18 of the vows in the reading. Print them out and look at them every day and just start doing it now. Start looking them over now while they're fresh in your mind. Because the next time they won't be new, they won't be fresh. You know, the course will come up again. You'll be like, oh, I already had that. Then you won't study it. So if you put it off, the likelihood of you doing it later just is not that likely. So do it now. Even if it's just like looking at it here and there.
Quick. So I used to have another notebook that I lost last week. I think I left it in the bathroom or something. Mm-hmm. So I went home, came back. Well, anyways, the first 9 vowels, is there, can I Google them and it'll be the same, or is there any?
If you go to acidharma.org.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We're on course 7 of the formal courses.
Okay.
So all of them are in the reading there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They're all in the notes, too.
Okay.
So there's a list there. Do you know that website?
I think it's the... Well, I have a few websites that I... there are a few websites where I can see the teachings of here.
Mm.
So... it's number 7, then I think I can
okay.
find it. But I'll wait.
Okay.
So it's, what's the Dharma?
ACI.
Mm-hmm.
ACI Dharma.
It's, okay.
Yep.
Asian Cultural
Institute. Asian Classics Institute.
Classics.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one that has a really fancy website with a lot of videos. From Geshe Michael?
I think they're probably thinking of the knowledge base.
Oh, yeah. That's
yeah. Yeah, that one's really cool. And then also, you can help each other. So if you see each other breaking a vow or doing something, you can correct each other in a good way. So it has to be with love and, like, a happy mood. But you're helping each other out. So it's not like you're chastising each other. You're just helping... to avoid more pain in the future, really. And Lord Atisha, he used to carry around an image of the Buddha, and people hated riding with him because they'd be riding their horse and he would stop all the time. Every time he had a bad thought, he would get down off of his horse, he would confess, he would take the time to do it, and then once he felt like he confessed, then he'd get back up, and then another thought, he would stop again. So he'd be constantly confessing all the time, because he didn't want to maybe die, get thrown off the horse with any of those negative thoughts or negative seeds having been planted. So it's really, if we can, that's kind of the idea of the six times a day book, is that you're always looking at it. So if you confess or do the four powers right away, it makes it a lot easier. The longer it sits there, it just grows, and you can kind of feel it's harder to cleanse it. You can still do it, but it takes longer. You have to keep going back and back and back and wearing it down. Whereas if you do it right away, you can just catch it before it's anything big. Okay. Let's end with prayers. Puki Chukshing Me Tok Chang Rirab Ling Shin Yen De Gen Padi Sangye Shingdu Mikte Uwagi Drokun Amdak Shing La Chupar Shu Hiram Guru Adna Mandala Kam Nirya Sayami Di ge wo kun sunam ye she sok sok shi sunam ye she le jung we tam pa ku ni to pa shu. So you're sending all the merit of coming to the teaching, sitting through class, thinking about these things, all of that to full enlightenment in this life for the sake of all beings.